Ani, welcome to Bom Sida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. Fisa Ace Dene have received an apology from the Manitoba government for the forced relocation of their community in 1956, and along with the apology, the province has also proposed a land settlement separate from any treaty land entitlement. Also in Manitoba, Long Plain First Nation has signed a municipal services agreement with the City of Winnipeg for a 1.4 hectare property in the city. And with recent controversy in BC over the Taseko Prosperity Mining Proposal Project, a consultant speaks out on better ways to secure environmental approval and consult First Nation communities. A member of Waikagamaw First Nation in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, has posted an ad on Kijiji looking for a good chief to run in the community's next election. And it's all in the family. The Métis Fiddler Quartet is performing this weekend in Penetanguishene, Ontario. Nicholas Delbert-Sawchuk of the quartet discusses the challenges and fun of performing with his family, as well as the importance of keeping traditional Métis music alive. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo has met with provincial and territorial premiers. The National Chief has challenged the leaders to improve education, boost earning power, and end violence against Aboriginal women. The Council of the Federation met with Aboriginal leaders August 4th. Atleo also recommended the Council pressure Ottawa to increase spending for First Nation schools. He said, "When we open a door to a school, we close a door to a jail cell." Manitoba Premier Greg Selinger has promised he would write the Prime Minister to request a national meeting on the issues. Atleo also urged the provinces to adopt four other measures in his action plan. The actions include developing resource revenue sharing agreements that recognize Aboriginal title in each province and territory, create a national strategy to study and stop violence against Indigenous women, establish a First Minister's meeting on Aboriginal issues, and sign on to the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. In Ontario, Constance Lake First Nation is without clean water. The Toronto Star reports the community of about 900 has been in a state of emergency for more than a week. Chief Arthur Moore has demanded Indian and Northern Affairs address the issue of the thick blue-green algae that covers large areas of the lake. The algae can't be filtered through the town's old water purification plant. The community has been shipping in bottled water as well as boiling their water. Moore also noted the irony of his community declaring a state of emergency on July 28th, the same day the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly passed a resolution recognizing water as a basic human right. And several powerful nations, including Canada, abstained. Though the resolution is not binding, global organizations are working on legislation that would be binding. Long Plain First Nation in Manitoba has signed a land deal for an urban reserve in Winnipeg. The community has signed a municipal services development agreement late last week. The agreement includes a 1.4 hectare piece of property to be established as the Long Plain Economic Zone. The property will be the site of a five-story office building, Yellow Quill College, and a gas station. Chief David Meaches says the site will also include a depot where citizens can have their items delivered for tax-free purchases.
The other option businesses under consideration is a what we call a tax-free zone, meaning that all businesses or people within the province of Manitoba will come to our property and have their items they purchase there delivered to our community as a tax-free zone.
In the agreement, the property will not be taxed by the municipal government, but city services will be provided under a negotiated fee structure. Meaches adds the deal will benefit the community, especially the youth.
The ultimate objective is bringing in a sense of pride for our community members, our youth, them becoming involved, and of course the spinoff for us at our main community would be the revenue so that we can continue to fund recreational activities for our youth and children and job creation.
Long Plain has about 3,800 members, and the community established an urban reserve in 1981 in Portage. A Waikagama community member has posted an ad on Kijiji looking for a good chief to run in the next election. A community member unhappy with the current chief posted that ad. Troy Gould wants the Indian Act Band Council to be reverted back to customary Mi'kmaq traditional government.
I feel there's a need for change. I see there's a need for change, and I see a possible solution, and that's through using the use of customary traditional practices. And the Mi'kmaq were part of the Wabanaki Confederacy, and we had longhouses.
Right now, Gould says the situation in the community is not good, and he wants to see the end of the Indian Act Band Council governments.
We see the Utes want to destroy themselves. We see the political system of the democratic INAC system doing the same thing as the residential schools, taking the Indian out of the Indian. And there's nobody here that's speaking out. This makes me very emotional, and I can feel my heart race sometimes. And I need to see a change. I feel that we can do a good job. We just need INAC out of the way. It's killing our people. Since we went to the INAC system, we have the highest incarceration, the highest suicide. This got to end.
The community's elections are coming up October 7th of this year. For the first time in 4 years, commercial salmon fishermen are getting the all clear to fish in the Fraser River in BC. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans had forecast that 11.4 million sockeye would return to the Fraser this year. But Stolo Fishery Advisor Ernie Cray told the Burnaby Newsleader that he's concerned DFO is moving too fast to let commercial boats take sockeye, particularly given the notorious inaccuracy of pre-season forecasts in recent years. Fraser returns for 2008 and 2009 ended up below 2 million sockeye. That issue is the subject of a judicial inquiry, which will resume this fall. The province of Manitoba has apologized to the Saisse Dene. The province has also offered land compensation for its role in the forced relocation of the Saisse Dene from Duck Lake to Churchill in 1956. Stephen Therassi is a member of the Council for the Community. He says the apology is welcome, and it's a big deal for the community.
It's a big thing for the community. It's opening the doors for our compensation, I guess you'd call it. So it's everybody's happy about it, and I hope something becomes out of this whole deal that's going to take place.
The province has also proposed to provide more than 13,000 acres of Crown land separate from any treaty land entitlement to help address the effects of the relocation. Tsilhqot'in Nation chiefs in BC are not happy with the province's announced plan to make a public offer to revenue-sharing First Nations over the Taseko Prosperity Mining Project. The chiefs have said that no amount of money can compensate for the devastating impacts the Prosperity Mine would have on Tsilhqot'in traditional lands and culture. The proposed copper and gold mine would have devastating impacts in a lick considered sacred by the people. An environmental report issued in July proposed the project would have significant high-magnitude impacts on productive fisheries, threatened grizzly bear populations, traditional use and cultural heritage, along with Aboriginal rights. The panel also specifically noted that First Nations have frequently stated that financial benefits could not compensate for the destruction. Meanwhile, David Hill is a director and advisor with GMG Consulting in BC, and he says conflict could have been avoided had the company consulted the Tsilhqot'in in the beginning of the project proposal.
Without wanting to say whether I think this project should go ahead or not, I can see where there were opportunities to possibly avoid this conflict. Finding out what's worked with First Nations from the front end and having them part of the planning process, because chances are they might have had a good idea around where a tailings pond might go or where a road might go.
And Chief Joe Alphonse, tribal chair of the Tsilhqot'in National Government, has dismissed the province's plan to make a public offer to First Nations as a desperate government trying to salvage a desperate mining company. This weekend, the Métis in Midland are celebrating Métis Day. The Métis Fiddler Quartet are joining the celebrations August 7th, and the quartet comprises of four siblings. Nicholas Dalbert-Sajak is the spokesman for the quartet, and he says Métis fiddle music is steeped with tradition and has adapted different cultural styles throughout its history.
I think it's a very unique tradition in of Canadian music, fiddle music repertoire. It's interesting because it has a very interesting rhythmic pattern. They have unique dances that go along with it, and it's also an important tradition which was kept alive in Canada. Some of it's actually a lot of old tunes from Scotland, which were preserved over here and often changed and altered because of and influenced by the communities who were playing them. And it's very interesting to hear the difference between a Scottish fiddler playing the same tune as a Métis fiddler playing the same tune, because it has changed much over time.
The 5th annual Beaujeu Niji Métis celebrations are being held August 7th at Discovery Harbour and Penetang Machine. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Well, I'm just sitting here just wondering why, watching out my window pane as I cry. How many times I've been doing this again, losing all focus, trying to hide my rain. I try to reach for the innocence in my heart, my pride, but I'm strong and trying to hold it deep. Try to stay as open to those that seem to be right. I try not to run away from me this time. I try to keep in focus and keep things in sight. Who should I trust in? Who should I fight? Reach for the freedom, 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 reach for the
singer-songwriter Violet Natohau from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, with Freedom from her CD Wind of the North, produced in 2007. The province of Manitoba has made an apology to the Saisse Dene for the forced relocation of the community in 1956. The province has also proposed over 13,000 acres of land as compensation for the relocation outside of any treaty land entitlement to help address the effects of the relocation. Stephen Therassi is a member of the Council for the Saisse Ese Dene, and he spoke with Bomsida about the apology and the land offer.
We sat down with the Minister of for Manitoba and Eric Robinson. Well, they gave us an apology, and I think that's something good that happened, a historic thing that happened for our people. We never got that kind of situation that took place before from any government officials. So it's a big thing for communities that's opening the doors for our compensation, I guess you'd call it. Everybody's happy about it, and I hope something becomes out of this whole deal that's going to take place.
And Stephen, what exactly was the apology for?
Well, the move from 1956, the government took the people from their own traditional lands, from Duck Lake, a place called Duck Lake, and they moved them to the shores of Churchill without even consenting with the outside world. They just brought the plane. People have to move because they're declining too much caribou, and that's our livelihood. They were storing, what they were doing was they were storing meat for the fall of that winter, and that's only deep freeze that we have that to go over under the snow and then dig out for it in the winter, so it'll be still frozen by the time people get at it. So that's what they were doing, and they said they were slaughtering too much caribou. That's the reason why they moved the people.
Wow. And the other thing now is that since the province apologized, it's now promising to provide more than 13,000 acres of Crown land. And what does your community think about that?
They knew what's going to become of this, because it was discussed before with the land claims. And the acres that we're going to be getting, I think it's a pretty big land that we're going to get. So I think people are happy with what they're going to be getting. It wouldn't be just the land. There'd probably be some dollar signs involved, too.
So where is that 13,000 acres of land? Is it at Churchill or Duck Lake?
Well, it's up to us. Duck Lake, I think that's where it's going to... You can get that land, I guess.
So as close to the original territory as possible?
Yes.
When will the community be obtaining or receiving the Crown land?
Well, this is just opening the doors negotiation. The ministers will be coming to our community to talk about this once everything takes place, I guess. So that's a good thing, too.
That was Stephen Therese, Say Dene member of council. Long Plain First Nation has recently signed a services agreement with the City of Winnipeg. The agreement for a 1.4 hectare property in the city will be tax-free and will be a host of many other opportunities for the large community of nearly 4,000. Chief David Meeches discusses the agreement and what it means for the community.
What we signed was a municipal services development agreement, which spells out the specific and general services that we would receive from the City of Winnipeg for a property we own there, and which would also include a structural fee.
And so what does that mean?
Well, what it means is that we will pay on a fee-for-service basis for water, sewer, fire, policing, garbage pickup, things of that nature.
Okay, in that parcel there, it will. I also understand that it will be tax-free, and you're going to be doing some developments there. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we're currently looking at, there's an existing 30,000 square foot building there that's currently being renovated for educational institution in Manitoba called Iroquois College. We're also putting up a gas station there and a 80,000 square foot office complex. And one of the other businesses under consideration is a what we call tax-free zone, meaning that all businesses or people within the province of Manitoba will come to our property and have their items they purchased there delivered to our community as a tax-free zone.
Wow, that sounds really good. Do you think that would work, like for instance, cars and boats and different things like that to be delivered to your tax-free zone?
Yeah, so we're also looking at furniture and we have Winnipeg being the hub of Manitoba for our First Nation citizens. Come to Winnipeg for various, and we're hoping to capitalize on being the only ones within the city with with what we call our economic development zone.
You were saying that development of the area is estimated at about $15 million, and can you tell us what that means?
Well, we're looking at approximately $15 million to develop what the building, the gas bar, including the renovation of the existing building. But however, I think that's the infrastructure cost and all the other costs associated with creating whatever businesses that will be, of course, be a separate cost.
Right, I understand. And there's also, I bet, a lot of potential for future business and other organizations to lease buildings on your property.
Yeah, we've got most of our, probably about 70% of our property already leased out.
And what does this all mean to your community, which has nearly 4,000 members?
Well, first and foremost, I think the ultimate objective is bringing in a sense of pride for our community. Our community members, our youth, them becoming involved, and of course the spinoff for us at our main community would be the revenue, so that we can continue to fund recreational activities for our youth and children, and job creation.
Sounds great. And how long has your community been working on this deal with Winnipeg?
Well, in about 5 years now since we purchased the property, however, there was a different plan to be for the property initially, and I was elected a year and about a year and a half ago or so, and so it's taken us about a year to get to this point in terms of the municipal services agreement.
I see. And how are you able to purchase the property, and how much did it go for?
Well, we purchased it for, I believe, $1.2 million for 2.4 acres. And we purchased it through our treaty land entitlement money.
That was David Meeches, Chief of Long Plain First Nation. He was discussing the recent services agreement with the City of Winnipeg. Desiree Dorian released her first CD when she was just 13 years old, and she hasn't looked back since. The country singer-songwriter who hails from Edmonton just released her newest album, Soul Black Jack. Now here's the title track to that album.
I'm sick and I'm tired of this run around. I got my high heels on and I'm hitting the town. There was a time when the thought of you was enough to keep me home, crying the blues. Did you really think you could keep me down? I'm mother's daughter, you should know by now. I got a soul back. Tears. My hair, it's looking just right. The boys are getting whiplash 'cause my jeans are so tight. My soul back, Jack.
There's been some recent heated controversy over the Taseko Prosperity Gold and Copper Mining Project in BC. The mining company wants to turn a lake sacred to the Tsilhqot'in people into a tailings pond for the mine. The province has announced it will make a public offer of money to First Nations for the mine, and the Tsilhqot'in have dismissed that announcement. There has also been much in the media, from newspapers to bloggers, weighing in on the issue, and it's not all good. David Hill is a director and senior advisor for GMG Consulting Services in BC. He also weighed in on the controversy, but also expanded to some advice for other mining companies. Hill recently wrote an editorial which was published in the Canadian Mining Journal, and we discussed the article he wrote for the publication.
I was inspired by a number of articles I've been reading lately I was particularly inspired by the current Prosperity Mine application that's going in front of the Canadian Environmental Agency for review, and some of the controversy that seems to be stirring up around that. One reporter in Victoria Times columnist actually characterized the options available to the company as to either move the planned tailings pond for a cost of $800 million or provide a financial incentive to the First Nation. I felt that was sort of an unfair mischaracterization of the issue, as though there was sort of an either-or situation. You either bend to the will of the First Nation environmentally or pay them off. And I've seen that too much in the last 10 years of work, and I was inspired to sort of write an article about what I see as a potential third way.
And what is that third way?
Well, I guess it's not just one way. It's any number of ways. But rather than sort of setting up this situation where a company has to, go through the regulatory process and then at the tail end hope that the First Nation either ignores it or can be bought off financially for either jobs or an impact benefit agreement. What I see is a more effective way is for companies to engage early with the impact of First Nations. And I know that many companies do. And I know Taseko, for example, has spent many years, trying to work with the Tsilhqot'in First Nation to gain their support of the project. And it hasn't worked out. But in many cases, what we see is companies have the opportunity to come in early, find out what the needs and the opportunities and the desired outcomes of the First Nation are, and start there, sit down at the table and say, what do you want from this project? What do you as your desired future? And then sort of overlay that with the planning for the mine or for the logging operation, the highway construction or the mall, whatever is being dealt with, rather than assuming that it's we can give you money or we can give you jobs or training. Sit down and find out what the First Nations' interests are, find out what their goals are, and see if there's a way that they can work together to achieve them, rather than just assuming it's a financial interest. That's an oversimplification, I think, of the process. It isn't just a one-stop deal where you walk in and say, what do you want, and we'll give it to you, nor should the company be seen as a vending machine where the community can say, well, we want this, and push the button and get it. But too often I see companies leaving it to the last minute to say, well, what are the First Nations interests? Make a bunch of assumptions about what they are, and only to find out that they're not really what the First Nation wants. And then you lead to this sort of unnecessary conflict and then this taking of sides, which I'm seeing in the media. And that's what frustrates me is when I see these, this either-or scenario playing out.
And that seems to be kind of what's going on right now with the Taseko Prosperity mining project, especially with that journalist talking about, if it doesn't work, then offer the First Nation community some financial incentives to get them on board. The province is doing just that, kind of offering money, but the Tsilhqot'in and the other First Nations are still saying no because they just don't want the tailings pond there, period. And do you have any suggestions for that?
Well, I'll be really clear that I'm not going to take a position as to whether I think the mine should go forward or not. And I'm not a biologist, and I can't say whether that particular pond is a good idea or not. But what I can say is that, the First Nation's been really clear from the outset, as far as I can tell in media anyway, that they're not interested in having that tailings pond in that spot. I'm not very impressed with the ministry coming forward and sort of offering up this this red herring of whatever amount of money they may have offered them. And, you know, I think that's going to set up more public, sort of fuel the fire of the public either or continuum, where people who don't understand the issue might say, well, look what the First Nations turned down. They're just blackmailing the company for more money. I actually saw a comment like that posted on one of the blog sites. But what I can say is that for many, many First Nations, many communities, what's at stake usually isn't about money. Sure, they're going to take money if it's offered. Who wouldn't? But often when you get sit down with a community at the front end and say, what is it that's of value to you? What are your needs? Here's our plan. What do you think of this? You know, the Chilcotin probably early on would have said, well, Fish Lake is kind of out of the question because it's sacred to us. It has environmental resources. It has, you know, food heritage resources and so on. And we'd like to see something different prior to the company spending $100 million in planning, prior to going through the extensive and lengthy provincial environmental assessment process, and then to have it approved, and now it's going to Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency. It's so far down the line now, it's sort of, the company is sort of hung out there now, saying, well, you know, our only options are either to cancel the whole project at great economic expense, or go through a huge planning process and more delays to change its mind. They're in an almost impossible situation. So, you know, again, without wanting to say whether I think this project should go ahead or not, I can see where there were opportunities to possibly avoid this conflict by finding out what's worked with the First Nation from the front end and having them part of the planning process. Because chances are they might have had a good idea around where tailings pond might go or where a road might go. And I'll give you an example of where I saw that work. About 5 years ago, NovaGold, which has since been bought by Teck Cominco, was planning the Eskay Creek project up in up near Dease Lake. And they came in wanting to get the Tahltan First Nations approval for a road, which they were going to run alongside the Skeena River and damage a whole bunch of habitat and so on. And then they came up with another option, which was to tunnel through a mountain, which was very expensive, and they really didn't want to do that. Well, the Tahltan, because it was early on, said, well, the Skeena River, Skeena River option doesn't work for us. It's too valuable for us. We want to see the tunnel as a better option. The company wasn't in favor of it, but because they were there early, they could adjust their plans, do their financing, and actually come up with that solution. So there was a case where the company was able to be ahead of the curve, work with the First Nation, come up with a plan that worked, and yeah, it was more expensive than the original plan, but it was early enough in the process that they were able to work it out.
That was David Hill, a director and senior advisor with GMG Consulting Services. Just earlier this week, I came across a surprising ad on Kijiji. Someone had posted an ad entitled, Good Chief Wanted, Waikagaba First Nation. The ad outlined what qualities a chief must not have, like stealing, lying, cheating, bribing, contraband smuggling, drug trafficking, nepotism, and so on. The ad also outlined what a good chief must know, things like Mi'kmaq traditional knowledge and governance, First Nations history, best practices in business, and you get the picture. CBC has reported the chief there, Morley Gugu, has defended a $60,000 youth trip to the Dominican Republic, and 2 years ago, the Chronicle Herald reported that the chief was sentenced to 60 hours of community service, banned from drinking alcohol and taking prescription drugs following an assault on his estranged wife. And Troy Gould is a member of Waikagaba First Nation, and he's the one that posted the ad for a good chief on the Kijiji website.
I feel there's a need for change. I see there's a need for change, and I see a possible solution, and that's through using the use of customary traditional practices. And the Mi'kmaq were part of the Wabanaki Confederacy, and we had longhouses. And the reason why I say we had is because we don't have them anymore. And the women were the holders of the longhouse. And they had, not only did they have fair share in political say, they were owners of all the property. And we've been removed from that so much that it's causing genocide. And it's very disturbing to me. We see the Utes wanting to destroy themselves. We see the political system of the democratic INAC system doing the same thing as the residential schools, taking the Indian out of the Indian. And there's nobody here that's speaking out. And this makes me very emotional. And I can feel my heart race sometimes. I need to see a change. I feel that we can do a good job. We just need INAC out of the way. It's killing our people. Since we went to the INAC system, we have the highest incarceration, the highest suicide. This got to end. And we have to revert back to our traditional ways.
So one of the other things is you're looking for certain qualities in a chief that you have on your posting.
Yes.
And those are?
Well, it's a very shady chief we have here. It's very secretive. There's a lot of things missing. Equipment, license, boats, wharves. Our Utes, one of them shot themselves. And the other one hung himself. And I knew these kids. And I love my people. I want to see change. And I love my elders. And they're being marginalized by this democratic system. And I want to have a public debate with him. And I'm going to put an official challenge at a public debate on podium, on mics, cameras. It doesn't matter. I want to question him. I need answers. Why are the Utes trying to destroy themselves? Why does he have to use exotic trips, bribery with drugs and alcohol to our Utes?
So I'm going to get back to the Kijiji ad.
Okay.
And you've made some very serious allegations during our conversation, but we're going to bring it back to the ad.
Okay.
I was just wondering, and I thought it was a bit confusing that you're looking for an ad for the chief and saying, you know, the chief, whoever is going to run in the next election, doesn't have to be the community or even Mi'kmaq or First Nations. But at the same time, you're talking about the customary traditional practices that your community had practiced pre-Indian Act. And so don't you think that maybe there's a way that if you're practicing your customary traditional ways, that you yourself could get in there and make those changes that you're talking about?
Did you mean to become an INAC chief? No, I don't wish to become an INAC chief. I haven't voted in this system since I was 19. And I'm related to, through my mother's clan, we're related to the Labradors. And we cannot, if we relinquish our titles. And if you look on the internet, Charlie Labrador, the Elder Scripps, he's been recorded. There's videos there. We're related to him. They're saying that he's my uncle. And he was the last recorded customary hereditary chief that never gave up his title to the INAC system. Now, I've never been baptized. And when Chief Mertu made the treaty, Wampum Treaty, he held the axe away from the cross. And that signifies that we are allowed to go refuse Catholicism and go to our traditional ways. And it's Wabanaki. We're part of a greater Wabanaki Confederacy that's not being used. And I believe with the Wabanaki Confederacy, with the backing of the elders and the clan mothers, and we bring back the longhouse. By the way, my father's residential school survivor, same with my mom. They're getting settlements. My dad, he understands exactly what we're doing. And he's going to be building us a longhouse here. And through this, we're going to use arbitrary law, the Sundance chief, to challenge the INAC system. Even if we have to go to court. I have the backing and the blessings to say this news. And I know it seems like I'm contradicting, but that's how this system is. The whole system is contradicts itself. Now, INAC, to me, stands for apartheid. It doesn't stand for nothing else. It stands for how to oppress the indigenous people. That's all.
So I have one comment or question. Is a couple of weeks ago during the Assembly of First Nations General Annual Meeting, the National Chief Sean Atleo talked about that he's challenging all the chiefs across Canada within 2 to 5 years to come up with something else or other proposals to replace the Indian Act in the communities? And do you see that those comments with any hope? And we don't have much time left.
Yes, I caught that too, and I believe this.
That was Troy Gould, a member of Waikagama First Nation, who posted an ad on Kijiji looking for a good chief to run in the community's next election coming up in October. Was Robert Sanderson's Cow by the Métis Fiddle Quartet, a family of musicians who will be playing at Métis celebrations this weekend in Penetanguishene, Ontario. Nicholas Delbert-Sodchak is the spokesman for his family quartet, and he spoke with Bomseda.
Well, we are a family ensemble of four siblings. My sister Alyssa is on viola. She's the eldest of the family. And my brother Conlon sings and plays guitar. He is the second of the family. My name is Nicholas, and I'm the fiddler. I'm the third of the family, and my brother, little brother Dantal, plays cello and does some piano for us, for our group. And we do original arrangements of old-time Métis fiddle music, and we throw in various influences, and we hope to, by incorporating different elements into this music, that we'll be able to pursue a strong musical career as a well-rounded artist not only as just fiddlers, but as like as people who take this music forward and bring it into other art forms.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. And how long has your family been performing together?
Well, we've been playing together ever since we were very young. But in the last 4 years, we have gotten together and really tightened ourselves, and we've been taking this much more seriously. So in the last 6 months, we've really put it together because what we've been preparing for our new album with our members only, which is going to be our first. And it's quite an amazing experience to be working with your siblings. You know, it's not easiest to people to be working with, but it's also a very important thing to be doing.
I would imagine so. I was going to ask, it looks like all of you have different musical influences, and does that get in the way at all when you're creating your music and about having any artistic differences?
Well, it's not easy, but we make it happen. And during the summertime, we spend a lot of our time performing together. But in the school year, since my brother was in Ottawa studying, he's finishing up his undergrad. My sister is studying in Switzerland, and I'm studying in Toronto, and my little brother's going to be starting high school this year. So we were all in different places, but we have managed to get together and pull some things together for us, and it's been quite amazing because we have been all over the place. We have had amazing opportunities to play music for many people, and that's the most amazing thing for me.
So as far as the traditional Métis fiddle music, how does that influence your music as a group?
Well, it's very important because I've had several opportunities to work with elders across Canada. I've worked with principally with Teddy Boy Hool, who is an elder from northern Manitoba. I've worked with John Arcand, who's just recently gotten an Order of Canada for his work with Métis music. I've also worked with an elder named James Chichu, who's from Northern Ontario. He's quite amazing. I was also at a fiddle conference in Newfoundland, and I also got to work with an elder all the way from Kugluktuk, Nunavut. His name is Colin Adunman. He was a very funny guy, and I had a great time working with him. I'm always going to remember my experience, although it was only a few days with him. So that's quite important to me. The music is essential to our music.
Well, that's incredibly awesome. And I'm going to be playing one of the tracks, Robert Sanderson's Cow. Can you tell me about that one?
Yes, actually, there's an interesting story behind it. This is a tune that was inspired by a cow falling into a well, and he wasn't able to get out. That's what the tune is sort of inspired by.
Okay, how important is it to keep Métis fiddle music alive?
It is extremely important. I think it's a very unique tradition in of Canadian music, fiddle music repertoire. It's interesting because it has a very interesting rhythmic pattern. They have unique pieces that go along with it. And it's also an important tradition, which was, kept alive in Canada. Some of it's actually a lot of old tunes from Scotland, which were preserved over here and often changed and altered because of and influenced by the communities who were playing them. And it's very interesting to hear the difference between a Scottish fiddler playing the same tune as a Métis fiddler playing the same tune because it has changed so much over time.
Great. And you're going to be playing this weekend in Penetanguishene. You want to tell me a little bit about the where you're going to be playing?
This weekend, I'm going to be playing in Midland for Métis Heritage Day. We're playing a few performances throughout the day. So I believe we actually just got confirmation of the times right now. I believe it's 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and I believe 3 o'clock. It has just been updated, so I just got that information. But it's going to be fantastic. We're playing for a beautiful Métis community up there, and everybody is welcome to come. I believe it's an open and free event. So anybody who's available around there is welcome to come.
That was Nicholas Delbert-Sawchuk of the Métis Fiddle Quartet, who will be performing this weekend in Penetangoshene for the 5th annual Métis celebrations. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.